I think the organisms have adequately been shown to be promotional, that in fact, once they get involved with the cancers, they accelerate probably the tumor. And perhaps one of the best examples, again, is Julia Drewis' work showing that if a person has a biofilm and begins to develop a polyp, that those biofilms intensify and begin to go down into the crypts, where of course the cells are that are the progenitor cells of colon cancer.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast from ISAP. We're a nonprofit scientific organization advancing science in probiotics, prebiotics, and related fields. This episode is part of our series exploring gut microbiota and colorectal cancer. We'll be speaking with experts about how microbes in the human gut contribute to colorectal cancer development and how this research is driving advances in diagnosis and treatment.
Hi, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
Today's guest on the podcast, we're delighted to have Cindy Sears. And I'm going to read out Cindy's title because it's quite a long one here and I want to get it right. Cindy is a professor of medicine, oncology, molecular microbiology and immunology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the Bloomberg School of Public Health. And the reason we asked Cindy to join us today is her work on the link between the microbiome or microbes and colorectal cancer, which is a series we're doing. Cindy, how did you become interested, in involving the gut microbiome and colorectal cancer? Cancer, unfortunately, is something that's going to touch almost all of us in our lives. So I understand the importance of the disease, but the link to microbes, how did you get involved there?
Well, about a quarter of a century ago, 25 years ago, I actually was involved in the field of global health and diarrheal disease infections and started there as an infectious diseases fellow. And when I came to Hopkins, I got handed a very interesting project by the internationally known Dr. Brad Sack, also a leader in diarrheal disease who has since passed. And what they had was a particular pathogen that had been causing diarrhea in lambs, and the link between animals and humans in terms of diarrheal disease is pretty strong. But for this particular pathogen, which had been discovered by Dr. Lyle Myers in Montana, they didn't have an assay beyond lamb ligated loops, not a practical assay anywhere in the world. And so he came to me with concentrated culture supernatant and asked me if we could develop an assay. And through work and some luck, we developed a microscopic assay that allowed us to tell which Bacteroides fragilis strains, an unusual organism in thinking about diarrheal disease, might be producing a toxin. And with that, that enabled us to speed forward and purify the toxin and find the gene and begin to understand this pathogen. And what that led to was we did a lot of assays in the lab and we kept bumping into cancer pathways, which was out of my realm of expertise, certainly at that point in time. And eventually I said to myself, well, we need to ask the obvious question. Is this organism oncogenic in a gastrointestinal tumor model? And indeed, we used what's called the MIN mouse or the multiple intestinal neoplasia mouse, which is heterozygous for the adenomatosis polyposis coli gene, which is mutated about 80% or more of colon cancer. And indeed, our first experiment was spectacularly positive. And, you know, no one relies on a single experiment, but it was pretty dramatic. And that led me to involve Drew Pardoll, an immunologist, because there was a lot of inflammation. And from there, we started working on this topic and really focused on what we call enterotoxigenic Bacteroides fragilis, because it can cause diarrhea. It's also associated with inflammatory bowel disease and now colon cancer. Through our work, which was mostly preclinical, but has transitioned done by other investigators to clinical observations. And that's what we did for about the next decade. And then it felt too simple to me. That gut is very complex. We were learning about that microbiota, and the idea that you could pin colon cancer on a single organism just felt uncertain to me. I didn't think it quite mirrored Helicobacter pylori, definitely carcinogenic in a different environment. And so we stepped back and I said, well, let's just look at all the microbiota. And so we decided to stain colon cancer and control tissues with an all-bacterial probe, a 16S all-bacterial probe that fluoresced. And in that initial set of experiments, we recognized that a subset of colon cancer had these conglomerates, huge conglomerates of bacteria that were fixed to the surface of the tumors. And after we unraveled that by plotting them on a picture of the colon to see if there was a geographical relationship, we indeed identified that about 90% of colon cancers in the cecum, ascending colon to the hepatic flexure, bear these complex biofilms. And between a study here at Johns Hopkins and a parallel study done in Kuala Lumpur, we identified that about half of the colon cancers beyond the hepatic flexure also bore these biofilms. And so that was about 15 years ago. And since that time, we've been continuing to try to unravel what those biofilms are and how they affect colon cancer development.
Of course, as a simplistic microbiologist, I would say this is great news. Now we're going to prevent cancer with antibiotics.
Oh.
Why aren't we doing that?
Well, we did show that these biofilms are oncogenic in mass, right, by grinding up tissue and putting them into the min-mouse model. But we also observed along the way that individuals who got antibiotics for PrEP before surgery, the biofilms would be diminished, not necessarily gone, and that the evidence is soft, but it appeared that they reassemble very quickly. So the conditions in the gut are such that I don't think antibiotics will have much impact on colon cancer, although that has been discussed with the observations that there are bacteria in distal metastases. And that may work in a select mouse model, but I'm very dubious that that's going to be helpful to patients.
Cindy, your work is remarkable in that it's been characterized by these groundbreaking experimental studies, but then you've also done reviews that have stood the test of time in this remarkable way. I'm thinking of the review you did with Wendy Garrett in 2013, and there you set up a approach that allows one to talk about the evidence for individual organisms as well as for the biofilms. And then that kind of then culminated in the next decade of research. And you then have recently written a review that looks at the biofilms in the context of IPD. I wonder how you'd like to give us your thoughts about the roles of individual organisms as well as biofilms themselves.
Yeah, so along the way, we observed in the biofilms that at least some had these dramatic populations of Fusobacterium, which was also an observation being made by others in the field and initially first highlighted by two papers in about 2012 that were done by others. So we've looked carefully at that, and there's definitely a subset of biofilms that have a dominant amount of Fusobacteria. But our data, which was published recently, associates that with advancing cancer, that the organism may be there, but it becomes prominent at stage two or beyond for colon cancer. We also became interested in the polyketide synthase, again, E. coli, also due to the work of the Clevers group and others in the field, and are currently working on that as a potential candidate to promote colon cancer. And most recently, because Julia Drewis in the lab wanted to understand exactly who was in certain biofilms. She did what we call culturomics, which is a huge amount of work. And she cultured down all the bugs, got about 30 from a particular biofilm she focused on. And what we identified was it had none of our usual suspects, but indeed had C. difficile. And that led us to test the idea that C. difficile could be oncogenic. So from my perspective, we are still very much in a learning phase. And I don't think there's any solid causal evidence that a bug triggers the onset of the mutations for colon cancer. I think the organisms have adequately been shown to be promotional, that in fact, once they get involved with the cancers, they accelerate probably the tumor. And perhaps one of the best examples, again, is Julia Drewis' work showing that if a person has a biofilm and begins to develop a polyp, that those biofilms intensify and begin to go down into the crypts, where, of course, the cells are that are the progenitor cells of colon cancer. So it's they evolve together. And I think the organisms are certainly contributing to colon cancer, but not necessarily causal.
Yeah, I think it's perhaps not surprising to a microbiologist to hear, you know, when the environment changes, the microbiome in that environment changes. So you would expect that as a cancer develops, that the microbiome would react and change in concert with that. But the initial triggering event, of course, is what we're particularly interested in. Can the bacteria trigger cancer over any other genotoxic kind of compound or something? Do you think it's, I'm struggling to find a way to almost ask it, that it's a toxic thing that the bacteria do? Very often bacteria release a toxin in order to generate a kind of more favorable environment for itself, to get the epithelial cells to release something or to change in some way that is favorable to the bacterium. Do you think this could be just, you know, a commensal bacterium with a host tissue and the connection just somehow goes wrong? Or that it's, and I shouldn't be using these terms, but a deliberate attempt or an attempt to generate a reward for itself by a bacterium to trigger cancer, if you can follow the convoluted question there.
So I think that we all have events that happen over our lives that modify our microbiome in ways we are only beginning to discover. And one of the ones that we got involved in, as well as other labs, is the effect of antibiotics short-term, long-term on the microbiota. And I think in the infectious disease field, we keep shifting towards shorter courses, more targeted courses of antibiotics because of our understanding that these changes that antibiotics do to the microbiome are certainly a source of C. difficile infection, for example. But I think it goes beyond that, that some of us can repair our microbiota satisfactorily, perhaps based on other host factors, our weight, our physical activity, our diet, and others, smoking, diabetes, and so forth. And some of us aren't so successful at that. So I think we get multiple hits, and over time we develop a dysbiosis, you know, things aren't quite in balance. And I think that allows these organisms to create a niche more effectively for themselves that can be harmful to colon epithelial cells. And there's a recent paper that showed that some bugs that we sort of routinely say just are commensals, just as you say, Bifidobacterium, Fecalobacterium, Prutzenitzii, things like that, can actually be harmful and toxigenic in the gut. So we have these very complex issues of strain variability, species variability that make it difficult to pinpoint in an individual exactly why they got colon cancer. I think it's a conglomeration of personal factors, host factors, and your microbiota and its evolution over time. Does that make sense?
Do you have any thoughts about the dramatic increase in early onset colorectal cancer and how that is a reflection of changes in the environment and host susceptibility and perhaps the microbiome role?
Yeah, I suspect this is a topic that we're working on, but there's no clear-cut answer yet to my knowledge. But we have identified that, or others have identified, that polyketide synthase E. coli are present in young children, and that the emerging data seems to suggest that normal epithelial cells, which we in the past would have said shouldn't have these potentially oncogenic mutations, may have this particular mutations linked to the colobactin gene in those strains. And whether those can persist and change over time, or is that true with enterotoxigenic Bacteroides fragilis or any others, is not clear. We had tried to look at the direct genomic effects of the enterotoxigenic Bacteroides fragilis and didn't find any, but you know, every study has its boundaries. And so, you know, did we look the right way? I think these are very complex questions, and we don't know about epigenetics or methylation changes and how that gene regulation may also be affecting early onset colorectal cancer. Plus the host factors. We know we were overusing antibiotics in the 1980s and 1990s, although some of this EOCRC has now been traced back to perhaps the 1950s. We've had an obesity epidemic that's definitely pro-tumor. We know that C. difficile has expanded in children. Some of that is due to advanced therapies that have emerged over that period of time. So my guess is it's more than one factor. But and PFAS is another topic that's recently come into consideration. So the forever chemicals, what are they really doing to our host makeup?
And I wonder in microbial terms, again, bring it back to the microbiome. I think I agree with you that it's unlikely that we're just going to get a single smoking gun of Fusobacterium nucleatum or whatever it's called now. They change their name so often. Anomalous, I think.
Right.
You know, could produce a toxin, which could be triggering something, which could then trigger and so on. The cascade of events happen after that. But it could be that in someone else's gut, what we call a toxin in that context is actually something that is beneficial to the gut in some way, reduces inflammation or generates an inflammatory response where one is desirable. And so, you know, the old semantics kind of when is a toxin not a toxin, or, you know, a flower in the wrong place is a weed, or a weed in the wrong place is a flower. Do you think that could be that, you know, bacteria performing their normal function? We're just creating such an environment with the environmental changes and, of course, living so much longer than would have been traditional or throughout evolutionary history, that these are almost inevitable, that, you know, something has to kill us and something has to go wrong with the relationship between the gut and the microbiome at some point, or we're going to live forever. Or do you think these are genuine, that we could really think of these in terms as like pathogens, that if we could get rid of them, we could solve the problem? I know, again, a very woolly question, but
I think our ability to pluck out, quote, a pathogen from the microbiota is very unlikely. And I'm basing that on two studies with C. difficile, which has very acute effects, and people would love to get rid of colonization, right? But they both failed. So you were unable to pluck it out, even with seemingly appropriate antibiotics. So I think of these things in terms of protecting ourselves, in terms of community. So I may be carrying C. difficile for all I know, but if I have a resilient community around it, the organism is largely neutralized, I want to say. Although, you know, there could be chronic, tiny inflammation. We know 100% of all GI cancers have associated inflammation. It's fairly subtle, but it's there, which is why aspirin prevention works for some individuals who are likely to have colon cancer over time, like Lynch syndrome or FAP, things like that.
Yeah, it's multifactorial, it seems, and that makes it hard to do the experiments correctly. Like if you're trying to implicate a particular organism, but the state of health of the barrier is a key role, then you'll need to have a factorial experiment where you compromise the barrier or not, and then see what happens with and without certain consortium of microbiota. So,
well, we already know from old infection experiments with salmonella or with, let's take salmonella, that you can give some people 10 to 9 salmonella and they just shrug it off, and give another person 1,000 salmonella and they could end up, being very ill or even dying as a result of that infection. So yeah, you're right. It's so multifactorial. I don't think we're going to get to that smoking gun. So how do you think this information will inform therapy or prevention going forward?
In my mind, it's about prevention. So my hope is that through these various types of experiments, and either potentially a serology that says you've been exposed to X, Y, or Z, and your microbiome, that we could put together a test that would be cost-effective and inexpensive to be used as a prevention test beginning at age 20, which I just made up, right? We know that some of this early onset is occurring in adolescence, which is horrifying, as well as in people in their early 20s. So my vision is that we need to have a tool that helps predict who's at higher risk in these younger populations. Not everybody on the planet will get a colonoscopy. That's not financially feasible. But if we could identify a subset at risk, then we could follow them over time. And the hope would be we could identify when indeed an invasive procedure is required, or one of the other stool screening tests to identify if there may be a reason to be more concerned.
Yeah, I can imagine that as an infectious disease clinician, that as the state of knowledge develops, it would have to get quite a bit farther from where it is now. That kind of prediction model could even inform your decisions about prescribing courses of antibiotics, because one of the things you kind of alluded to is the antibiotic courses that were given many years ago still could potentially influence the risk, the cancer risk for a patient.
Yeah, and that's correct. Andrew Chan at Harvard has published papers. We published a paper suggesting that only 15 days of total antibiotic exposure may increase the incidence of colon cancer. And other investigators have also found similar findings. So we know the cost of antibiotics is real, and I think we have to factor that into how we treat patients.
And do you think there might be a role, and I'm speaking now on an ISAP podcast, so there's a bias here, but for things like prebiotics, probiotics, postbiotics, things that are perhaps not what you would expect a cancer specialist to reach for, you expect them to reach for chemotherapy and checkpoint inhibitors and surgery. These are the dramatic interventions. Do you think these biotics could help to shape the microbiome in ways that could reduce risk, extend the time maybe for a cancer to develop, things like that?
I think it's feasible. I'm probably more keen on the idea of prebiotics because they help to foster what we think are better bacteria, such as short chain fatty acid producing bacteria and the like. I don't think we have a firm lead on that. I think we're learning from the C. difficile field. And I'm very interested in these newer products that are more community-oriented, such as the VE303 study. And I should acknowledge that I'm a PI for that here at Hopkins. But the idea that you could take a small consortium that might be able to reinforce, if you will, your microbiome is appealing. Other broader strokes without detailed study are less appealing to me.
Cindy, as an international thought leader in this field, I wonder what you think would need to happen in order to fund a rigorous prevention trial. Once we got to the point that we had interventions that we thought there was good evidence for those, because there may not be a proprietary interest per se in that, but there could be a role for governments to fund that.
Well, that's probably something I'm not an expert on. I think it's a complex question. And part of the problem issues for thinking about it is the long timeline from the initiation of a colon cancer to even the ability to see a polyp, which my gastroenterologists tell me is about 10 years. And at that stage, it's not a cancer, so you can get rid of them. And that decreases your cancer risk. So it's a very complex question. And in those 10 years, other things happen to people. So, you know, doing a controlled human experiment seems daunting to me at this point in time.
And do you think there might be something to be learned from existing cohorts? I mean, there are people on Earth with much lower colorectal cancer rates. And of course, they miss a lot of the environmental factors that we've just been talking about. Do you think there's something cross-sectional almost could be done there to help?
Yeah, I do think employing all the large data sets could be helpful. For example, the Harvard group, again, had recently published that they could identify the subtle changes in the microbiota, I think, more than 10 years before, feeding into the idea that there's a true chronicity here, that we need to be able to recognize specifically enough to be able to apply it to patient care.
Well, thank you, Cindy. It's been so nice talking to you and to get this input from someone who's spent such a long time working on this. I hope our listeners will follow up by reading some of your papers and particularly some of the reviews that Dan mentioned. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for inviting me and for highlighting this topic. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.